You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 12th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, two guests. First, Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent at Time Magazine, author of Big Vape, The Incendiary Rise of Juul. And then we'll be talking to Dr. Mark Allen Derry, infectious disease specialist at Access Health Louisiana, the host of the Noise Filter podcast. But first, Anthony Fauci declares Omicron coming for most of us, as the majority of Europe will be catching it. Joe Biden endorses filibuster reform in what feels like an increasingly inconsequential rhetorical bid. Angus King to unveil a bill designed to stop a rerun of the Trump 2020 flip electors plan. Consumer prices jump again as Powell says the Fed may raise rates. 8,000 Kroger's employees go on strike across the country. Biden administration weighs new mask distribution plans. And the UN calls for $5 billion in aid to save Afghanistan. Lastly, U.S. temperatures in 2021 hit records on both extremes. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Wednesday. Emma Viglin is here to put that into context for us.
Yes, it's hump day. It's hump
Thank
day.
You. Thank you. It is hump day.
Hello.
Did I screw up the intro? Did I not say the heartland of America today?
I don't know. I was like, I had trouble sleeping like, last night. I'm a little,
I was gonna say,
I'm really just, tired. Yeah.
I had to take a nap too. I don't know. That's going around.
When I saw you lay down to take a nap, I thought, oh my God, I wish that was me.
Yeah. Well, you got to get in there early to nap.
Executive
the
privilege.
Show. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know why. Just like one of those nights I could not fall asleep. So
I was making the decision. I was like, one couch or two couches? I'm like, I'm only going to need one.
Yeah. Wow.
Yep. There you go.
That's the kind of boss you are.
That's
say,
right.
If you want a nap, you get on the dirt floor.
That's
people don't realize that we broadcast out of a barn.
We do not have a paved or any type of flooring.
We That's do right. not have paved flooring.
That's right. But the good thing is, in the spring, we can then plant and grow our own food
and our own sebede.
There we exactly. Which incidentally, there is a new report out now. I don't know that it has anything to do with. I got to look into that. But there is a report out that different types of sebede A and G, I think it is, scientists have done a peer-reviewed study that I believe it was in Nature magazine, that apparently in combination with a vaccination, this cannabinoid. And I'm not exactly sure how it works. If you do, would you just take it, or it's unclear. And I want to make it clear: I have no idea if it's even the same product that is in the Sunset Lake stuff that we promote. So I don't want anybody to make that mistake. Although we're going to look into it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of research on that.
We're going to do a lot of research on it. They couldn't do the research on the THC because, of course, it's still illegal on a federal level.
Can we get half the energy behind the hydroxychloroquine behind this sort of ban?
Unbelievable. But the scientists found that it I guess it inhibits the spike protein. Maybe we'll talk to Mark Allen Derry about this. This report just came out, I think, today. So I don't know how many people have caught up with it. But we will look into that. But I don't know. That was pretty... that was pretty interesting. Now, of course, that will be... If everything goes to... I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, like, what happens with that information. Because if what we've been told is true, a million Substacks are going to grow now to talk about how this is not being promoted properly. Right? Isn't that the way this works?
The cannabinoids thing?
Yeah. Right? I mean, cause this because this would immediately... Those people will be assassinated.
Well, there's nothing to commodify there. It's the anti... If it's anti-cannabis, then it's...
No, it's pro-cannabis.
I thought you said it inhibited the...
It inhibits the spike protein. It inhibits COVID.
This is going to be a long show for
me. Oh, my gosh.
The Substack thing is about...
Emma did not show up today.
Yeah. I was saying I have more of this cold brew.
Yeah.
It doesn't flatter reactionaries, so no, I don't think it will be popular on Substack.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. Now, if this is working properly, Anthony Fauci has already sent out a team of assassins to take out those researchers and all of the publications that have written about it. Fact, this could be the last time that I'm around until, you know, the assassins come for me.
Right.
And then, of course, a million Substacks will grow around the my being deplatformed and assassinated. So, all right, let's get to this Joe Biden in Georgia.
Ugh.
Now, as much as like I share your ugh with this, we should also say that yesterday Mitt Romney is on the floor of the Senate comparing this speech by Biden to what Trump did in the last election. And let's be clear about what we're talking about. We don't know exactly what the legislation that would be passed at this point, because Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema have decided that the filibuster is too sacrosanct. But it is a not unreasonable assumption that any legislation that passes by the Democrats would reinstate the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, which has been law of the land, or was, from 1965 to 2013, before a conservative Supreme Court decided that, in fact, racism had ended in this country. And I'm not being, that's not hyperbole. Hyperbole. Or
not,
hyperbole.
It's not hyperbole.
It's neither.
Antonin
Scalia basically said, like, you know, enough of giving minorities special treatment. And then, of course, as soon as the Supreme Court gutted Section 5, you saw a bevy of these same states that were under the preclearance provision go and institute voting changes that inhibited black people's and disenfranchised black people.
They said racism was solved, so there was no need anymore.
No need. But here is Joe Biden delivering this speech in Atlanta, and you know, here it is.
Today, we call on Congress to get done what history will judge. Pass the Freedom to Vote Act. Pass it now, which will prevent voter suppression. So here in Georgia, there's full access to voting by mail. There are enough drop boxes during enough hours so that you can bring food and water as well to people waiting in line. The Freedom to Vote Act takes on election subversion to protect nonpartisan electors, officials who are doing their job from intimidation and interference. It would get dark money out of politics, create fair district maps, and ending partisan gerrymandering. Look, it's also time to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. I've been having these quiet conversations with the members of Congress for the last 2 months. I'm tired of being quiet. Folks, it'll restore the strength of the Voting Rights Act of 65, the one President Johnson signed after John Lewis was beaten, nearly killed on Bloody Sunday, only to have the Supreme Court weaken it multiple times over the past decade. Restoring the Voting Rights Act would mean the Justice Department can stop discriminatory laws before they go into effect. Before they go into effect.
I mean, all well and good. I suspect that maybe there should have been a slightly bigger investment than 2 months of being quiet with the senators. Maybe we should have seen this coming down the pike a little bit. Maybe a year into the presidency. Could have been maybe 3 or 4 months, even maybe 2.5 months, maybe 9 or 10 weeks. I mean, can you imagine LBJ? I'm really tired of whispering to people. Maybe you shouldn't have been so quiet. Maybe there should have been usage of the powers of the presidency to leverage Joe Manchin's behavior. I don't know what that could be. Like, how about some executive orders that make coal that much more difficult to profit on? Or, I mean, is there really nothing to investigate? Like, yeah, I mean, this is stuff is hardball politics. But it's not enough to say, like, I'm tired of being quiet.
Yeah. Well, why why is he quiet? I mean, that's also feeding into this exact perception with Biden that he doesn't really know how to lead forcefully.
It's this generic Democrat register, like, it's the Republicans who are standing in the way. But it's like, you got to get your guys. You should be marching to West Virginia and Arizona.
And for those of you who are out there, like, and I don't know if there's anybody listening to this who've said this, but I've seen people on Twitter talk about what we need to do is get Susan Collins and Mitt Romney. And we will talk about the Thomas Friedman article today, which suggests that maybe Liz Cheney should be vice president.
Liz
or whichever. It doesn't really matter. Dick Cheney, for that matter, has as much makes as much sense as far as I'm concerned. Thomas Friedman, honestly, I think, like, if you've ever seen, I saw my dog have a stroke.
Yeah.
It was really disturbing. It reminded me of reading that piece, the Thomas Friedman piece. It was like watching someone have an aneurysm right in front of you.
You're right. Your dog did have a stroke, though. It was like through the whole old time warp from, Again, I need to
listen to Mitt Romney on the floor of the Senate. Let's just play a little bit of this just to get a sense of just how bat crap crazy the Republicans are. This is Mitt Romney, the reasonable one.
Mr. President.
Senator from Utah.
Mr. President, I prepared some remarks to give this evening, but I had the occasion to watch President Biden as he spoke in Georgia just a few minutes ago, and he said quite a number of things that simply weren't true. He also accused a number of my good and principled colleagues in the Senate of having sinister, even racist inclinations. He charged that voting against his bill allies us with Bull Connor, George Wallace, and Jefferson Davis. So much for unifying the country and working across the aisle. More troubling, however, he said that the goal of some Republicans is to, quote, turn the will of the voters into a mere suggestion. And so President Biden goes down the same tragic road taken by President Trump, casting doubt on the reliability of American elections.
Oh, God.
This is all a right. Sad.
I don't even want to hear anymore. First off, yes, when you reverse Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, even though it had been reauthorized by the Senate, and you prevent that fix, yes, you are aligning with some of the more well-known racists in the country in the past who have tried to prevent black people from voting. And when members of your own party were plotting to overthrow the election by changing, you know, the electors that were sent from the state, et cetera, et cetera, I mean, we've seen the documents, then yeah, you were doing that. Mitt Romney, the one with the principles.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why you're dividing the country here, Sam. But, like, I mean, I think part of why Republicans like Mitt Romney are so dangerous, because when we uplifted the perspective of, like, the never Trump Republican, it gives credence to these false both sides-isms that they rely on. So, I mean, that should be completely cast aside as ridiculous as it is. But he has legitimacy, and his perspective does, for some reason, because he's like the kind of Republican that people think is reasonable. But that's an insane statement.
The chances of praising Republicans as a way of making other Republicans look bad, not coming back to bite you in the ass, is 0%. Everybody who venerated Bush or Romney or, you know, Frum or whomever it is, this is what you get. This is why people are like, well, I mean, Republicans can't be that bad. Why, we were platforming and listening to him the whole time. How bad was Donald Trump? Donald Trump was the problem, not Republicans. Insane. All right, we're going to be talking in just a moment to Jamie Ducharme, the health correspondent, Time, author of Big Vape and the Incendiary Rise of Juul. Before we do, just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget our big live show, May 15th, Boston at the Wilbur Theater. I noticed that Buffalo Tom, my favorite bands from Boston, they bumped their show that was actually going to happen at the end of this month in New York. They bumped it all the way to August.
Good company.
Wow. So what does that mean? Now you can go?
No, now we can bump stuff. It's okay that we bumped it because another...
Yeah, Buffalo Tom is bumping their show. I'm going to bump my show. We may even bump the show again just to...
Yeah.
We'll reschedule it and then bump it again. But you can get the tickets at Majority Live. Check it out. Also, shop.majorityreportradio.com. We were going to have the big coming out of our scarves. We're going to be at the live show, but it's next.
Oh, the Majority Report scarves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're nice wool.
Scarves.
Not itchy.
That's one thing we agree on, scarves.
Yes.
Excellent.
Don't sleep on the scarves, folks. All right. I want to welcome to the program Jamie Ducharme. She's a health correspondent at Time and author of Big Vape, The Incendiary Rise of Juul. Jamie, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thanks so much for having me.
I was excited to have you on because this Juul, I don't want to tell any tales out of school, but I do have a teenage daughter. There have been issues in the past, not as of late, but back, you know, when she was not as mature as she is now.
Being very subtle about this. No one knows what you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. My kid got busted for juuling in junior high. So,
you are not alone. That is very, very common.
Well, let's go. I want to talk about this because there's actually been, over the past couple months, some action on this and then some lack of action. But before we get there, give us a little bit of a history of Juul and particularly e-cigarettes, because there still seems to be some question as to the value of these things to society in some way.
Yeah, so it's actually a longer history than some people might realize. I'll try to keep it brief, though. Essentially, e-cigarettes first showed up in the U.S. around 2007. Back then, they either kind of looked like cigarettes, you know, very, very closely modeled to that, or they were these big, bulky things that were kind of annoying to lug around. You had to refill it yourself. Not a lot of people were into that. Juul,
I can interrupt you just one moment. Sure. I think people go back on YouTube and look in 2008. Mark Maron and I tested out some electronic cigarettes for Break Room Live. And that must have been 2008 because we were both a little bit smoky at that time.
Early adopters.
Somebody brought in from a tech. It was a tech thing. It was like somebody from CNET.
They're big contraptions, right?
No, this was the smaller one, the cigarette one.
Yeah, they did kind of start off as like a techie novelty device almost. Like some people were using them to quit smoking, but it was also sort of just this weird, like, hey, they made a cigarette electronic. Like, we got to try this out. They would sell them in mall kiosks. Like, they were truly a novelty product in the beginning. But when Juul launched in 2015, they really changed all of that. I mean, the device, as most people I think know by now, looks just like a flash drive. It's very sleek. It's metallic. It looks kind of like an Apple product. And suddenly people were not embarrassed to be seen using these products. They weren't the big bulky ones. They weren't the novelty cigarette knockoffs. So Juul's product really kind of started to take off after, you know, it sold slowly at first and then took off quickly. Because it looked nice and because it delivered a lot of nicotine in a very potent small dose.
And you can have different flavors. I mean, I'm not sure what the flavor situation was prior to Juul, but like, I'm sure that there wasn't a pina colada pod that you could just put in. And I know Sam loves pina colada flavored things.
So actually I will say Juul never made pina colada flavors. Those flavors actually did predate Juul. So when Juul launched, they had fruit, mint, tobacco, and I'm drawing a blank, maybe creme brulee. I believe they launched with creme brulee. So they actually had a smaller menu of flavors than a lot of companies that were making like unicorn tears and gummy bear and some of the crazier ones.
All right. Well, so, I mean, just back up just a little bit. And what ostensibly was the point of this? I mean, this is coming at a time where really I think like, you know, smoking... The rate of smoking, you know, during the, I guess it was in the aughts. I'm trying to remember now when smoking was outlawed in bars. I feel like it was in the late 90s. But it changed obviously at different places around the country. But the rate of smoking, it seems to me, particularly in terms of adoption, but also the number of quitting in this country during the aughts, the rate of smoking was like dropping like a stone. And so what was like, where was the impetus, not just for Juul, but all of this, coming from? Like, how much of it was big tobacco figuring out like what's another mechanism that we can have? How much of it was, this is a way to get people off of cigarettes? And how much of it was just like, oh, if we plug it into the computer, people will buy it because it looks like technology.
Yeah. So actually in the very earliest days of the industry, big tobacco really wasn't terribly involved. A lot of the early companies were kind of like startups, scrappy little operations. And that's what Juul was in the beginning. And then I think as these products started to get popular, as people, you know, some people were using them to stop smoking, to wean themselves off cigarettes. Some people were using them just because they were kind of like techie and fun and they enjoyed it. But as they started to get popular among that variety of different groups, then I think cigarette companies kind of sat up and said, hey, a lot of people are using these new products. If they use them as intended, they will stop smoking cigarettes. So perhaps we should get involved in this. And, you know, they spin it differently. They'll say that they believe that combustible tobacco is on its way out and all of these things. And that's probably true to an extent, but it was also a huge business opportunity for them. And it was a way to kind of staunch the bleeding of people, as you say, increasingly realizing that smoking's terrible and that they shouldn't be using cigarettes anymore.
What, tell us just about particularly because Juul is the most, or was, I guess, the most popular iteration of this, right? Was there any other like version of this stuff that broke through in the way that Juul did?
No, I still think to this day, Juul is probably, if somebody knows the name of one e-cigarette, it's Juul, I would argue. So they launched in 2015. Both founders were ex-smokers who kind of designed the product because they thought it was something that would help them and people like them who enjoyed smoking, frankly, but also knew that it was bad for them and needed something to kind of fill that void. Both really smart guys. They met in a product design program at Stanford, which I think helps explain why it's so sleek and why it's so easy to use and why it's just a better product, frankly, than a lot of what had been out there before. And those attributes combined with marketing, which I'm sure we will get into soon, I think helped Juul really become the first kind of household name e-cigarette.
Do we have data at this point before we get into the marketing, which I think is sort of the most controversial aspect of this? And but do we have data on A, its efficacy in getting people to quit smoking, and B, the health? I mean, those are the two real issues. And I should say that I can't remember what brand it was. It wasn't Juul because it was prior to that. But there was something like around, you know, I was still chipping, as it were, back in like maybe the late aughts and around 2010. And I think it was like my last gasp of being a cigarette smoker was probably just finishing off those last couple with a day with an e-cigarette. And that only lasted like a month or two. I mean, I was already, you know, basically had shut the door, but it made it just a little bit, the transition just a little bit easier.
Right. And there is data to support that. I mean, it's hard to find data about one specific company unless it's funded by that company, which obviously comes with some conflict of interest issues. But when you look at e-cigarettes as a category, they are not harmless. I mean, you're still inhaling nicotine and chemicals and things into your lungs, which if the choice is that or fresh air, you should pick fresh air. But when you compare them to combustible cigarettes, which are among the deadliest products in the world, it does seem that vaping is at least better for you or less bad for you. So some of the most compelling data I've seen suggests that people who use e-cigarettes about 10% of the time, a little bit more, will successfully quit smoking. And that doesn't sound great, and it's not, but when you look at other nicotine replacement therapies like patches and gums, they're even less effective. So e-cigarettes are not probably a cure-all to the smoking problem, but they're also potentially a useful tool for some people.
But what's the difference in concentration of nicotine in something like a Juul pod versus, say, you're going to smoke, I don't know, how much does like a regular smoker smoke per day, I guess?
Yeah, the easiest comparison is a Juul pod is roughly equivalent to a pack of cigarettes.
One pod, okay.
And do we have a sense of, I mean, putting aside, and we'll talk a little bit about the scare that was out there, which, you know, I have mixed feelings about, frankly, the way that it was reported in the final analysis. But do we have a sense of like the health implications of e-cigarettes, and you can make blanket statements about the health implications of cigarettes, and then obviously within the context of that, there are some that are probably worse than others, because some had maybe, I don't know, at one time people would say, like, you know, one brand had like fiberglass filters or something like that. But can we make a statement as to the health implications of e-cigarettes, of vapes? What's the variance in there, and where do those problems come from?
Sure. So I think one important caveat before getting into that is that because these products haven't been around super long, there isn't long-term data. There just can't be based on how long they've been available. So no one can really tell you what happens if you Juul every day for 30 years, because no one has done that. But what I will say is, based on the data that we have today, I think it's fair to say that vaping is worse for you than not using any tobacco product at all, but it's probably less dangerous than smoking cigarettes. So it's a real spectrum. I mean, the companies themselves will say, if you don't currently smoke, do not use our product. But most experts that I've talked to, you know, with varying levels of confidence, will say that for a current smoker, it is a less dangerous choice to pick up an e-cigarette instead.
All right, let's talk about the sort of the controversy before we get into the how valid or how sincere those leaders of those companies are when they say, if you don't currently smoke, don't smoke cigarettes. Meanwhile, here's some gummy bear flavor or creme brulee, which, of course, you know, for those people who don't smoke cigarettes, there are no creme brulee cigarettes. They don't exist, nor do the gummy bear cigarettes exist. But first, let's talk about this controversy, because there was, I think, more than anything else, that controversy that existed, that people were dying from Juul's cigarette, was the one thing that got a lot of teenagers off it, because that stuff travels in Instagram and Snapchat circles in a way that, like, nothing as when I was a kid ever did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think what you're referring to is in the summer of 2019, people, especially young people, especially teenagers, suddenly started turning up in emergency rooms with really scary, kind of inexplicable lung damage. And people at first had no idea what it was. It took, a couple dozen of these cases for doctors to start putting the pieces together and realize that vaping seemed to be the common thread. And it took even longer for them to figure out that most people who got sick had used illicit THC or marijuana vaping products. So in the time that it took to figure all of that out, there was just this message of vaping is dangerous. You know, people are coming into emergency rooms unable to breathe with lung failure because of vaping. And I think you're right. A lot of people saw those headlines and thought, oh my God, maybe this is not harmless water vapor that I'm inhaling into my lungs. I should stop doing this. And it took a long time, I think, for people, for the message to get out that it actually probably wasn't Juul and companies like Juul that were to blame, but the damage had been done. A lot of people were terrified and stopped vaping because of that story.
Talk about what happened in the wake of that and where we're at today with vaping. I mean, because they claim they were not marketing this to teenagers, but they were marketing this to teenagers.
Yes. So Juul's, the caveat on any, or the asterisk, I guess, on any story about Juul is that their actions don't always seem to match up with their words about who the product is intended for. They'll tell you all day long that it's meant for adult smokers and no one else. But then when you look back to the way they launched the company, it's now infamous. They launched with this very colorful, very flashy ad campaign, you know, models in their 20s, like dancing around with jewels, wearing cool clothes on neon backgrounds. And they plastered these ads, you know, in Times Square, on websites frequented by young people, on social media. And I think at best, you can claim that Juul was negligent in running a campaign like that. And at worst, you could argue that they, on some level, thought it might appeal to young people. The company denies that wholeheartedly, always has. But there's a pretty large subset of people who don't buy that and think that they knew exactly what they were doing with that kind of marketing.
Yeah, I think I am in that camp.
Yeah, you know what? I go back and forth. I've talked to, through the course of reporting my book, I've talked to a lot of people at the company who claim that it was more of negligence, that nobody in that room really thought through what they were doing. Nobody knew exactly what the implications of this campaign would be. And I think looking at it, it's hard for me to imagine seeing that campaign and thinking, this is fine. You know, this is going to appeal to a 40-year-old smoker. But I've also never come across a single person who said, you know what, we wanted to addict teenagers. So I think it's somewhere in the middle of gross negligence and sort of willfully letting it happen.
Right. That's not a great sort of section to be in.
It's not. Absolutely not.
All right. So lastly, so where are we on this in terms of the FDA, in terms of, I mean, fortunately, I think like the Juul wave has subsided. I say that fortunately because I got another kid who's younger who will end up being in junior high in a couple of years. And the market share I mean, it's still billions of dollars, or their market capitalization for this company is still billions of dollars. So it's not gone away. But where is the FDA on this? Where is the government and what has happened?
Sure. So 2019, I would say, was the peak of the Juul hysteria. That's when the latest percentage in 2019 was that almost 30% of high school students said that they were using e-cigarettes, which was staggering, crazy, especially because so few teenagers were smoking. And then I think starting with that lung disease outbreak that we discussed, that was kind of the beginning of the end for Juul. I mean, it was just one thing after another. Lawmakers started to really sit up and say, we need to do something about this. States started banning flavored e-cigarettes. The FDA eventually banned flavored pods, like the ones that Juul uses, entirely. So the company just had to, like, take most of its most lucrative products off the market. It was constantly getting sued, constantly getting hammered by lawmakers, and its market share just kept shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. It's, as you say, still a very profitable or very large company, but it is nowhere near as valuable as it was back then. And the place we find ourselves at now is that the FDA is going through one by one and deciding whether e-cigarettes can stay on the market in the U.S., whether they are beneficial enough to public health to kind of make up for the fact that teenagers use them and other downsides. And they were supposed to make those decisions this past fall. Most of them still have not come out, including that for Juul. So they are kind of in limbo at this moment, waiting to find out if they can continue to do business here.
You're a health writer. What's your opinion on this?
On whether they should stay on the market?
Yeah.
I think it's hard. I would not be surprised either way, honestly, either way that the FDA might decide. My personal feeling is that there probably is a benefit for smokers to a product like Juul, but I also think it might be hard for Juul specifically to overcome the legacy it has built for itself that we're talking about. I mean, that company is just inextricably tied to the image that it's marketing towards teenagers and that teenagers use the product. And I think it's almost sad to me that a product that potentially could have been useful if marketed in the correct way is now tarnished to the point that, you know, they're seen as the teen e-cigarette. So for that reason, I wouldn't be surprised if the FDA doesn't let them continue to do business.
And what is happening with cigarette smokers? In other words, like, are we 20 years out from cigarette smokers being virtually non-existent in this country? Anyways, I mean, this is obviously not to get into, you know, the fact that basically these cigarette companies are now just basically exporting these problems to other countries and whatnot. But putting that aside for a moment, the need for or the justification for e-cigarettes at this point seems to me to be exclusively for because we know how detrimental this is to people's health. Exclusively for people as a sort of therapy to get off of cigarettes, to mitigate harm. But how much of that harm is going to exist in 20 years, do you think?
I mean, yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. I think that's a great point. It is sort of an issue of diminishing returns where I agree. The only possible use case for an e-cigarette is that it's better than a combustible cigarette. And each year we're kind of hitting new historic lows in how many people are smoking. So feasibly, in a few decades, you know, that percentage is going to be vanishingly small, and there probably wouldn't be an argument to having a company like Juul on the market.
Well, Jamie Ducharme, the book is Big Vape, The Incendiary Rise of Juul. Folks can read your health correspondent at Time. Thanks so much for your time today, and we will put a link to your book at majority.fm.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you.
I think I said Time Magazine before. And it really, I mean, do they actually print it anymore? They
yes.
do? Okay. Yeah, I don't know if anybody says magazine anymore.
Don't you remember who the Time Person of the Year was?
No.
I forgot.
Yeah, I don't.
I know. Well, it's very stupid.
Was it Thomas Friedman?
It should be, based on this op-ed, but it was Elon Musk.
Oh, yeah, so. Same diff.
Yeah.
More or less. all right. Let's go right into it. I want to welcome back to the program Dr. Mark Allen Derry. He's an infectious disease specialist at Access Health Louisiana. also the host of the Noise Filter podcast, which can get you up to date on COVID and other related, I guess, COVID and COVID implications information on the reg. Mark Allen, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Sam. Hello, Emma.
Hey, Mark.
Last time we spoke, I think we were sort of like in the Delta era, as it were. Now we're in the Omicron era. You're down in New Orleans. We are a month away from Mardi Gras and whatnot. Like, just give us an update on what's happening in New Orleans.
Sure. So we actually just probably peaked out probably 2 or 3 days ago, which was very nerve-wracking for all of us that were watching the graph. In fact, my wife had a call into City Hall every morning and had the Y-axis adjusted. She was in charge of that project of the daily projections. And so she had to adjust the Y-axis every day because the numbers just kept getting higher and higher. So I think we just recently peaked out. Yesterday, we did implement mask mandates again for indoors. So that's really good news because all of us, I think, want to see, although we were slightly nervous about Mardi Gras. We had a long conversation, my wife and I did, because we belong to several Mardi Gras crews, and we were trying to figure out, were we going to participate this year or not? A majority of these things are done outdoors, but they are crowded. So there is going to be some changes in how Mardi Gras is going to be done. The parade routes are going to be more uniform. They're going to be a lot shorter. Of course, that implies there could be more people clustered together, but they're really trying to respond to the fact that right now there's significant shortages in EMS and police staff as well. So those are the kind of things that we are thinking about. I think what we're going to see is a smaller, somewhat COVID-modified Mardi Gras as we move forward. Hospitalizations are unfortunately going up here in New Orleans, and deaths are more or less stable. So I think I think we may have turned a corner.
Okay, so let's talk about that. And you know, you're mentioning that the Y-axis is going, you know, has been going straight up like this, and it's not really moving forward, you know, incrementally, obviously, with time. But will you see? Do you anticipate seeing the same trajectory with hospitalizations, seeing as how hospitalizations generally lag 14 days out and then deaths are 21 days out? Do you have a sense of what the relationship is going to be between those infections and the hospitalizations and the deaths at this point? Because we've been told that Omicron is supposedly milder. And I mean, is there some technical truth to that? And is it relevant, though, based upon the extra infections that Omicron is going to bring in that way? So, you know, if 10 people die in scenario one because 20 people got infected, these numbers are not correct, but I'm just doing them simple, or 30 people got infected, it's still 10 people dying. And, you know, you can't say Omicron is milder in terms of like the outcomes, if that many more people are getting infected, and even if the ratio of people dying or getting sick is less.
Yeah, it's 100%. And you have lots of things in there. So I'm going to try to pick them apart one by one. Let me start by saying, just this morning, I read a really interesting statistic that said that Omicron is as virulent as the original strain that emerged out of Wuhan, which is a really interesting way of thinking about it, because then we were super nervous about it, but we've had Alpha and we've had Delta. And when we say it's milder, well, let's put it into context. It's milder compared to Delta, but it's more on par with where we were with the original wild type strain. Now, we're not seeing the same amount of deaths as we did with wild type because more people are vaccinated. We have the use of monoclonal antibodies, and of course it's only one of three monoclonal antibodies that are effective against this Omicron strain. And then lastly, we have the use of steroids. So those are the three things that we're really seeing that have been really, really helpful. But to get to the real point of the question that I think you're asking here, Sam, is this. is that there are 7 studies. They were on animals and they were not on human studies, but they all say the same thing, that when you look at Omicron and you look at tissue from the bronchi, so here's your trachea, and it breaks off right into your lungs, right at that first part of that break off into your lungs where the bronchia are, the virus reproduces very, very well. In fact, it reproduces 70 times more effective than Delta. So that's why you're able to cough it up, and that's why it transmits so much easier. But when you look deep in the lungs, right, deep in the where the air sacs are, it actually doesn't reproduce very well there at all. And that's probably another reason why we're seeing that there isn't as much virulence, and in other words, severity of disease with the Omicron variants.
That's interesting. Do we have a sense? I mean, the big thing I think that people have is, like, do we have a sense of what the incidence of long COVID is, A, for Omicron, and then let's just, or we can go in the reverse order. Do we have a sense of what the incidence of long COVID was for wild type? I mean, for the wild type and for Delta? I mean, do we have data on this? Because I can never nail that down. Like, as to how often people get long COVID, or even what the criteria is to establish that someone has long COVID.
Well, that's a different story. That makes it very difficult. That's why it's so hard to kind of really be able to make that diagnosis. But for adults and for children, it's the same. It's anywhere between 10 to 20%. Usually most people cut the middle and say 15% is usually the incidence that we see with long COVID. And the thing that scares me the most about any of these viruses, or variants rather, is the development of long COVID, because the people that I've seen personally who've had long COVID are really miserable. They are having very, very difficult time at it. And right now, a majority of what we see is a lot of CNS, central nervous system issues, depression, brain fogginess, forgetfulness, low energy. But the thing that concerns me is over time, we will hopefully not see this, but what I am concerned about is pulmonary and cardiac issues, so lungs and heart issues as well. So those are the things. Now, whether or not Omicron, an infection of Omicron, does that lead to increases in long COVID, or does it lead to long COVID? We don't know yet because it's still so new. But I would imagine that with so many people getting Omicron, I mean, this is likely one of the most infectious viruses that we've ever known. And with so many people getting it, we will probably see increases in the diagnoses of long COVID. But that'll probably happen in another month or so.
But what about these reports that we're seeing out of, I think, the New York Times, but it was a CDC report published the other day about children potentially seeing increase in diabetes type 1 and 2 due to COVID. What's your take on some of that data and the research that's being done there?
Yeah, Emma, it's such a great question. And I saw the headlines and I just kind of read the first couple paragraphs. So I'm sorry that I don't have a really, really good educational answer for that. The way that I interpret that is that, especially in children, if you disrupt the immune system, or if you disrupt the homeostasis of the system to the point where you are going to get a child sick, you know, with COVID, that it doesn't surprise me that other disruptions in other homeostatic systems like the endocrine system, the hormonal system, could potentially occur as well. And so that's kind of how I interpret that. And I should look a little bit more closely, but I'm embarrassed to say that I'm an adult doctor, so I usually focus on the adult research. But I did see that. And again, I just interpreted that as disruption of homeostasis.
All good. Yeah.
When we talk about long COVID, do we know whether being vaccinated in any way implicates the idea of catching long COVID? I mean, obviously there's breakthrough cases, and what it seems to be clear, at least in the context of Omicron, is that if you're vaccinated, the severity of the short COVID, I guess, is generally less. Do we have any idea of how vaccination interacts with the idea of long COVID?
I don't know if there's any definitive studies out there that that are able to answer that, but I will say that the folks that I do know that do have long COVID were vaccinated. But I want to go back and answer, like, kind of go back to you, the first part of that question there, Sam, because there's a couple things there that I think are really interesting. One is, one thing that we do know and something that we learned since the last time we talked in August is that vaccination wanes over time. So hence this so-called booster. And I've always been talking about that. I think that the mRNA vaccines are going to ultimately be a 3-shot regimen with possible annual updates along the way, kind of like what we do with influenza. So the 2 shots, and after 6 months, immunization wanes. So that booster shot is so incredibly important. And what we have seen is that people who've been boosted have, they have lower, rates of getting COVID to begin with. And then the symptoms are less as well. Those rates are a little bit higher for people who have had 2 vaccines, and those rates are even higher for those that have had 1 vaccine, and the rates are higher for those that are completely unvaccinated. So very stepwise fashion like that. But the thing that I want to kind of remind everybody, because the thing that I hear about from my patients or people who say that they don't want to be vaccinated because you're still going to get Omicron or whatever, even if you are vaccinated, I just remind people the analogy that I always use. Vaccines are like seatbelts. A seatbelt obviously is not going to prevent you from getting into a car accident. But if you are in a car accident, that seatbelt's going to mitigate any injuries. And you have to think about the COVID vaccine as the same thing. The COVID vaccine is not going to prevent you from getting COVID. At one point, it did with the wild type strain. Because remember, this vaccine was created with that wild type strain in mind. And of course, it has since, you know, the variants have emerged one after the other. So we have to think of these as kind of being like seatbelts. It's not going to prevent you from getting COVID. So it's still important to mask. It's still important to social distance. But what we should see it as is that it mitigates the severity of disease so that we know that hospitalizations are significantly less for people who are boosted.
And is it also not possible that, the vaccine is also inhibiting other variants? Like, you know, we hear stories of them finding a variant in France. I mean, we don't know that there aren't other, I don't know, epsilon and lambda and other Greek letters out there that would have been, would be a variant of an issue for us now or in the future, but for the vaccine, right? I mean, if the vaccine inhibited Delta on some level, it could be inhibiting other potential variants that we're not even aware of.
Sure. I mean, so there's a couple of things. One is that you still have the, so let's talk about the one from south of France, IHU. So this is this is a new variant that's emerged from a man that came out of Cameroon and was, and infected 12 people, when he got back to south of France. Cameroon has a vaccination rate of 2.5%. So the vaccination rates are still so low in large portions of poor parts of the world, right? And so, especially in parts of Africa as well. And the other thing to consider too is that we haven't seen this yet, but certainly this is something that could happen, is that this virus also infects animals. So we could get to a point where you have somebody who has the virus, it goes to an animal, the animal then can have the virus, and then a variant can emerge from there and then could potentially reintroduce it back into the human population as well. So this is why we'll never see an eradication of something like COVID, because it is because there is so many animal populations that COVID could infect as well. So what we are going to be looking to do or to consider is that we are going to be living with COVID, and hopefully as things progress, we're going to see the virulence of the virus. In other words, the severity of the virus get less and less. Now we're seeing it here with Omicron. Now, this is one point in space, right? 2 points make a line and 3 points make a trend. So I don't know if the next variant, when one does emerge, because one invariably will emerge, if that will become less virulent, and then the one after that becomes less virulent, and after that, and then we're starting to see endemicity kind of we're creating that the virus becomes endemic into the population. And so that's ultimately where we want to go. But I'm not sure we're quite there yet. But Omicron certainly gives me, because I'm an optimistic guy, gives me the opportunity to kind of cross my fingers and hope that the next variants will continue to be less virulent, especially as we become more vaccinated.
Okay, so will you, like, I want to just explore that optimism a little bit. Is that optimism just, is it founded in the idea that the more people, that there is a trajectory or momentum in terms of a direction of virulence? Like, I mean, does the existence of Omicron actually increase the likelihood that the next variant will be less virulent? Or is it just like, it's still just like tossing a coin? Like, it really doesn't make a difference if it was heads or tails last time. It's every time you flip it, it's a different thing.
Right. I mean, that's a really thoughtful question, because Omicron did not emerge directly out of Delta. They're on completely phylogenetic trees. They're completely separate. It's the one, you know, they just kind of were the ones that popped and emerged and became successful from a virological perspective. So what this optimism is coming from, and Bradley, if you could pop up that infectious versus virulent graph that I sent you this morning, is that typically what happens, and I think we may have mentioned this before in the past, either viruses become more infectious and they move along that x-axis that we see there at the bottom, or they become more virulent as they move across that x-axis, or they become more infectious as they move up against the y-axis. But what you don't see are viruses that are really virulent and infectious, which is that one quadrant where it says more deadly there. That quadrant doesn't have any viruses in it, because they either go one direction or they go the other. They either become more infectious, they move up, horizontal against the x-axis, or they become more virulent. In other words, they become more deadly and they move up that y-axis. And so this is, I don't know if you remember this or not, this was from the Washington Post. This was the leaked document from the CDC from over the summer. And here you can see the SARS-CoV-2 Delta variant when compared to the pink box there, which is the wild type, that it shifted more infectious and it shifted slightly more virulent. Right. So what we are seeing with Omicron right now is that ideally it's likely to have become more infectious, but has dropped down a couple points on that y-axis and has become more infectious and less virulent. And so
closer to chickenpox. It's so closer to chickenpox on that.
I actually think that we're moving closer to potential, like we're moving closer to measles. I've not heard that. This is my speculation, but I've never seen anything spread as fast. When I looked at the graphs today, we have globally the highest case rates that we've ever had nationally, and then here in Louisiana, all three graphs are peaking. You know, they're still continuing to increase. We're seeing record number of cases. Thank you, Bradley. I appreciate it. So I think this optimism is coming from a place of somewhat historical sense that as viruses learn to become endemic into human populations, they become less virulent. Now, there's no rules that say they have to do it. We just observed it in the past. And I'm hopeful that with Omicron that we are seeing a trend forward. And this is, again, pure speculation. Fingers crossed that that's hope where we're going.
Is part of the reason why, if you move down that the axis of contagiousness, that it becomes less virulent, is part of the reason because we now have, even if Delta and Omicron are in different sort of like different species, if you will, for lack of, you know, I'm a layman, that you're covering more sort of like between the number of people who've had Delta, the number of people who've had Omicron, and the number of people who've been vaccinated, you're sort of like that Swiss cheese that prevents you from getting it or getting sick from it gets denser and denser, as it were. We're overlaying more and more sort of like polarization, that it just starts to, like, there's just less almost like oxygen or kindling for it. Like, the more that we get, you know, that Omicron in some way is going to build alongside the vaccination and the Delta infections, and it's just going to make us a little bit more robust in our defense against any future variant.
Yeah, I think that is hopefully the direction that we're going again. You know, what we are seeing right now is we saw that it peaked out in D.C. We saw that wastewater management in Boston is showing decreased viral loads because we're able to look at viral loads in wastewater. And so I think we are seeing such a rapid spike. And then it's peaking out. It peaked out in 2 weeks in South Africa. The same thing in UK. I think the word that I usually use is human wood. I think it's already kind of, it's run through the human wood, because either people were protected from being vaccinated, maybe being naturally immunized or being, having a natural infection from, or natural immunization from being previously infected. And then of course, all the other things that we have available to us to help mitigate, you know, beyond vaccinations, like I said, monoclonal antibodies and these new pills are going to be great. I think those are all different tools in the toolbox that we're going to have, that ultimately, like you said, when you look at that Swiss cheese theory, that the more layers that you add onto it, the less virulent over time we're going to see. We're not going to see something like we saw last year two years ago in 2020, where we were, you know, for lack of better terms, a virgin population. We had no immunity whatsoever to COVID, but now we are building up these levels of immunity that, again, it doesn't prevent you from getting COVID. You'll get possibly a variant, but ideally two things. One, it'll be significantly less severe. And two, hopefully it will not lead to long COVID issues as well. And we still don't know that second part yet.
What do you make about the dynamic now where we're finding more people, not more people, but there's more talk, at least, of finding people who are in the hospitals with COVID as opposed to in the hospitals because of COVID. And sort of tangential to that, when we look at hospitals that are pushed to the brink in terms of their capacity, which I imagine is diminished now relative to where it was 2 years ago, because people are exhausted. You must be exhausted. You can't have probably more staff and nurses and doctors than you did 2 years ago. I would imagine, broadly speaking, across the country, you know, hospital capacity is less. But when we look at the numbers of people who have COVID today, is that including a figure that also represents the average or typical number of people that are in a hospital? So if there's 100 people in the hospital today with COVID versus 100 people in the hospital with COVID in March of 2020, is the number of people who are there today with COVID actually represent less of a strain on the hospitals, assuming the hospitals are at the same level of capacity, because the person who, because some of those 100 people of COVID are in there also for non-COVID related things.
Broken leg, heart attack.
Right. Whereas in 2020, those were distinct groups of people.
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's a good question. So one of the things that you're going to see epidemiologists looking at is specifically going to be looking at things that you could definitively measure: hospitalizations, people on oxygen, ICU beds. Those are things that are going to be very easy to measure. Looking at the number of cases are difficult, especially because we are mostly looking at PCRs. I'm not sure if they're including antigen or rapid testing. I don't know if there's a fudge factor for every 10 positive PCRs. Do they include 5 positive antigens? I don't know. I haven't heard or read that yet. But the number of cases that we're seeing is just so incredibly high. Again, this goes back to how infectious this virus is. But the point that you're making, I think, is one that needs to be underscored. There's so much COVID happening right now, especially asymptomatic COVID. And because people, the antigen tests are not sensitive enough to pick them all up, you're going to the hospital because you have a broken leg, you have a heart attack, you've got gallbladder issues, whatever the case may be, they're going to always swab you the minute you get into the hospital, and they're going to use a PCR test. And what we're finding is that there's a lot of asymptomatic COVID being transmitted. And so that's what we're seeing in the hospitals. But the minute you get a COVID diagnosis, you're going to a COVID ward, right? You can't be on the general hospital ward. Even if you're asymptomatic, they're going to still cluster you together. So there is still, you know, utilization of services, because the COVID wards are very labor intensive. They're very PPE intensive. They're just a very, and people who are there, you know, even if you're not needing oxygen, it's still a very labor intensive process. So what it shows me is that there's way more COVID out there, and the hospitals are picking them up because they have the PCR test to be able to spare or to utilize so that they can make those diagnoses. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So does that suggest that the number of COVID patients that we had 2 years ago or a year and a half ago was actually probably higher?
But we No question about it, because we didn't have enough tests to be able to determine if they had COVID or not. We were still using other things at that point. Finally, we had some tests, but even then the testing was still so, you had to have come from China, or you had to have had this, or maybe an exposure. They were still so rigorous testing. So there's no question that we missed a lot of cases early on.
I got to ask you this question just because it's out there. How much extra money does a hospital get when somebody has COVID? Like, how much, like, you know, like, because, I mean, I'm looking at, and I certainly am not, I think, providers, all due respect, I don't think this necessarily implicates you, but the providers, we need to put them, you obviously run a huge Medicaid, the biggest Medicaid provider in Louisiana. But I think we need to, you know, ultimately, we need to cut costs. We need to be able to put everybody under a rubric where we have some sensible pricing. But as far as I can tell, this is not a great time for the hospital business in terms of making money. But are people making extra money with COVID? Is that why they're reporting COVID?
I mean, I think the testing companies probably are, and you know, maybe the insurance companies by denying care. But no, I'm not a hospital administrator. I don't think, you know, I've read, you know, and I've had to, you know, I was never a big social media person, but I had to definitely step away from social media at some points, especially when they were like, you know, the doctors are just saying it's COVID and so that you can get extra money. I've never seen or heard that. That's never been reflected in any of my billing. That's basically accusing me of fraud. And I'm not saying you're accusing me of fraud, but I'm just saying people.
I just wanted the opportunity to address this because there's some lunatics out there who are convinced that this is just like
a doctor commits fraud, they lose their license. You spend, you know, 5 years, 10 years preparing for medical school, 10 years for medical school and residency, and then you're going to call somebody to have COVID who does, that doesn't make any sense at all. You lose your entire, it doesn't make any sense at all. No, there's nobody is claiming fraud. And I don't think hospitals are sitting here making a lot of money on COVID. I think it's probably the exact opposite. And of course, this always speaks to the importance of a new healthcare system, one that is firmly implanted in a single payer system. But that's obviously a different thing. So I hear you, what you're saying. I've read what they've said. It does not match at all what happens inside a hospital at all. I've never heard or seen any of that happen.
Well, we're seeing the exact opposite. There's a clinic that maybe we'll cover this later in the show that was posing as a COVID testing site, but they were just giving all negative tests. I mean, like
those are the people who are getting rich, right?
Right.
Those are the people who are making money. I am quite convinced
there is some testing, like, you know, like I went into a bus up on Flatbush because I walked by and it was like COVID test, and I figure I'll get a rapid test and a PCR. And when I was done, I was like, when do I get the PCR results back? And they're like 5 to 7 days.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is a scam. This is a scam, because that is completely worthless. 5 to 7 days. Are you kidding me? Like, that is, it seems to me a test that's going to give you results 5 to 7 days is actually a detriment. It's worse. It's less than zero in terms of value, because I walk around, I'm like, well, I've been tested. Yeah. I don't have the results. Right. So I might as well just, you know, I can interact with people. And I'm convinced that they're, you know, that these companies have like some deal where it's like, with the lab, like, yeah, I want the discount. So no expediting of my thing. And they charge, you know, full price to the insurance company or whatever it is. But what?
Sam, can I pivot real quickly just to while we're talking about this? Bradley, can you put up that other slide I sent? I think this is something that's really confusing. I wanted to have the opportunity to talk about this. What you're looking at here is a graph here. At the bottom line, that pink line is the number of days it takes that you can detect with a PCR. And then above that, where it says detectable by lateral flow, that blue or black line there. So I want to just walk you through this graph to help you understand the difference between antigen and PCR tests, okay? And the reason why antigen tests aren't great, you could see there on day zero, you were exposed. On day one, you start to create a bit of a viral load. And about day 1.5 to 2, you are now detectable by PCR. So if you go in early, you could see that it's not the case with antigen testing. You still need another day or so. So the reason why you have these people who go in and get tested with antigen tests, but they're negative, but their PCRs are positive, this diagram explains that. And the other thing that is super important, you could see that PCR is detectable for a lot longer period of time. The antigen testing is only detectable for a very, very short period of time. But the thing that's the most important, and the reason why people who are vaccinated and boosted and are not seeing positive antigens, but they may see positive PCRs, is that they never generated enough of a viral load. So their viral load was too low to be detected by antigen, but enough to be detected by PCR. And so this, I think, is a really good graph to help us understand why some people are testing negative by antigen, but positive by PCR. And it's probably in the last 2 weeks, the question that I get the most. So I just wanted to just use this as an opportunity to kind of, to clarify that misunderstanding, especially for people who are vaccinated and boosted.
And just to be clear, the detectable by lateral flow is the home antigen test.
Yes, those are the antigen rapid tests. Lateral flow, antigen test, rapid tests are all the same.
Okay. And so, and also just to be clear that, you can show up on a PCR as positive and not have enough of a load to infect other people. Is that right?
No, I we don't know yet. I hadn't thought about that. I would not be comfortable making that statement. I think that you would still be able to infect others, probably at much lower rates. Obviously, you can see how high those viral loads go, but I would still, you know, that's why anybody who's positive, to continue wearing masking, social distancing, even if you've been boosted, you still may have a bit of a viral load and you could still potentially transmit to others.
Okay. And just one more question on this. And just because this is, you know, to me, this seems somewhat obvious, but I talk to people who don't seem to quite get this. At any point on that, you know, that curve there in the B area, as it were, or the infectious period, this is not an exact science insofar as our ability to detect where we are within that curve as an individual. So all we know is that if we layer on protections, whether that means a mask or the quality of a mask or the amount of time we spend with someone, or the context in which we spend that time with someone outside, inside, in a place with good ventilation or bad ventilation. And it's the combination of where we are on our arc of having this disease, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things sort of like become a stew, and it's different for each person, but you can reduce your ability to infect other people it can be like a gradation, right? I mean, this is like, you're just going, you can be in the gray area at any given time, and one tiny thing that you do to mitigate the exposure that you could get or your ability to transmit could make the difference.
100%. Absolutely. Again, masking, social distancing. And what you bring up is you look at that B. Okay. Look at that section B. Look at where the peak is. Now follow that down all the way to the bottom, the number of days. So that's 4.5 to 5 days since exposure. So it was really troubling, when the CDC came up with the recommendation. Look where the original, it was 14 days, right? So you could see 14 days. You were pretty much out of the period of infection. But nobody was doing 14 days or whatever. So they changed it to 10 days and they went from 10 days to 5 days, largely because the UK did it for healthcare workers, because healthcare workers are getting Omicron at 20 to 25% increases. And these are boosted healthcare workers that have to take time off of work. So the UK was like, our healthcare system is not going to be sustainable this way. So we're going to do 5 day asymptomatic, 5 days negative antigen, wear a mask when you go to work. So the CDC, a couple hours later, adopted those same guidelines. And then you guys saw, I think you reported on it. And I think I heard you report on it when then the airlines started writing letters to Dr. Rochelle Walensky. And it became clear that they were like, well, if you're doing it for healthcare workers, we should do it for all workers. But, and you know, the idea is that you're still supposed to be masked. Well, two things. One is that people who are unvaccinated, that graph of infectiousness can go out to 10 or 11 days. So if you're unvaccinated, you could still be infectious up to 10 or 11 days. If you're also unvaccinated, you're unlikely to be wearing masks. You're probably of the belief that masks are not necessary. So the recommendation by the CDC, just by looking at this graph right here, you could see on its face was really somewhat troublesome. And I think basically prioritizes profits over people. I mean, that's what it comes down to. America, you know, the business of America is business. And so I think that there was a leaning toward prioritizing the economic system than it was prioritizing people's health.
And we have a similar dynamic, it seems to me, with the schools, but this is absurd. I mean, is this absurd? Because the fact of the matter is that, like, at the end of the day, it's one thing to say we're going to send, we're in an emergency situation and we need healthcare workers in the hospital, and they are the most vigilant when it comes theoretically to protecting others and themselves. And if they're asymptomatic and they're at the end of like the, you know, they're right on the cusp, that we need to send them back in because the house is on fire and they're the only fire people that we have. But when it comes to schools, like, you can't change what the virus is going to do, and you're basically just saying we're going to ride this out. Right? I mean, isn't that basically what it is? We're just going to ride it out. You know, my kid hasn't had a teacher for...
Yeah.
Well, he had a teacher for the first time in, 8 days. And, but...
I spoke to a teacher yesterday. She said she went to school on Friday. There was no kids. That it had reached a point where every kid was completely quarantined and the entire school just consisted of teachers that were just in the building. This is unprecedented. And I think that the reason why you're seeing this return to school situation, I think is also the same thing, is that I think that the way that schools get reimbursed is if kids are attending classes. And and I'm not a school expert, and I'm sure that a lot of listeners are school experts, but my very vague understanding is that it's better off for kids to be in classes from the perspective of administration so they can get funded for that. And maybe what we really need to be doing is really focusing. And I know, and again, I'm not a parent, but I know, and I've heard from a lot of parents that that at-home schooling or the teleschooling is not ideal. But I think sending kids to schools only to have them go back home, I mean, that hurts everybody. I mean, our clinic system, we have lots of young mothers who are nurses and medical assistants or what have you. And the minute a kid gets sent back home, then they get pulled out, and then clinics start to, at least we've seen in our clinic system, like we have 35 clinics across the state that all start to get closed down or we're not able to provide the services that are necessary because, you know, moms or parents would be able to make the accommodations so that their kids could stay home and work from home to attend school. Maybe a grandparent or somebody else is there to do it while parents are at work. So it has become a mess. And I think that it's going to continue to do this for at least a couple of weeks more. We are going to be in this really, really messy time.
Let me ask you a question about, I think we're getting a sense of like, you know, what your perspective is on the federal response at this point. But let me ask you this. What is your sense? And again, if this is something you don't want to answer, you don't have to, because this is, you know, not necessarily a medical one, but it is, it seems to me like a public health one. At one point, and this is not, I am completely agnostic. I have no idea as to Fauci's expertise or any of it. And I can understand in my mind, at least I can work out why someone during the Trump era would say, I don't want to leave this job because if I leave, you know, he could appoint Corey Lewandowski to replace me or Jared. And I'm, you know, that is a detriment to public health. But at one point, does someone say, fair or not fair? And I would say probably not fair. I have become a distraction. You know, we have a clip of Anthony Fauci saying to Rand Paul, I went to your website and you're fundraising off of me. Not Fauci has no control over that. But at one point, do you say, maybe I am like the best thing for me to do for the public health of the country is to take my name out of the equation so that because they don't have the resources to create a boogeyman out of, Mark Allen Derry or Betty Stevenson, who's going to replace me. Like there's not enough time to build the machine. You know, like what is it your sense that maybe at one point, if you're becoming a distraction to sort of the federal response?
This morning, you know, I read the stories and I saw the interaction with Senator Paul, and I think it was Senator Johnson that he called a moron. I don't know who.
It wasn't Johnson, but
there were. There was a senator that was attacking him as well, and I asked myself, who was it? I'm sorry.
Marshall.
Marshall. So not, yeah, of course not Ron Johnson, my bad. I asked myself, how does he still get up every morning and still just take this abuse and do this? And so where I would slightly push back a little bit, Sam, and say, I think that whoever they would put that job, that they would then go on the attack. And so I think that Dr. Fauci does feel, you know, he's been doing this, you know, since the HIV and AIDS era, really. You know, I mean, he's been there, you know, and he was, listen, I'll be honest with you, as infectious disease doctor, especially someone like myself who considers himself progressive, we were not big fans of Dr. Fauci through the HIV and the 90s eras. He pivoted a bit during the 2000 era. Certainly his response with Ebola was quite good and the H5N1, you know, he slowly got better. But, you know, the early years, he, you know, kind of partook in some of the homophobia of the time and some of the racism that was associated with HIV. I'm not saying that he is a homophobe or he was racist, but he didn't push back against a lot of that verbiage in those days. Like he's pushing back big time now. You know, it would have been nice to see him do that early in the early HIV and AIDS days. But that being said, I think they're going to create a boogeyman unless it is a Jared. But if you put a Mark Allen Derry there, you'd get the same thing. If you put a Rochelle Walensky, who's the CDC director in that spot, you get the same thing. So I think that you're right. I've never seen him as a distraction, but I see where the question is coming from. But I feel very good knowing that he's there and watching him fight a bit more and kind of having him roll up his sleeves a little bit and pushing back a bit. Because if you don't push back, you're going to just continue to pick on you. And because they're fundraising off of it, every time Rand Paul, I'm sure Rand Paul's like, oh, we got Fauci today. Great. You know, give me some great talking points because he knows he's going to get on TV and they're going to cover it. And you're right. It is a distraction. And I don't know what the right answer is there, Sam, quite honestly.
All right. Fair enough. All right. So lastly, let me ask you this. And I don't know if anybody else has got another question, but And I just saw this report today, so you may not have caught up to this or may not know about it, but the stuff about the cannabinoids, the CBDA and the CBDG. I don't know if you've seen that report, but I'm curious to get your take on it if you have.
I haven't. What, just saying that the cannabinoids are helpful, or
there was apparently there's a study that is done that I think has been peer reviewed. It's been done over the past 8 months that they found that
the NIH just posted on their site. So
in conjunction with the vaccination, that it inhibits the ability of the spike proteins to connect. I mean, it's pretty cursory what they've written up there, so I haven't seen the actual report, but
I will say this. So Sam, the last time we talked, we kind of ended on masking, and I wanted to kind of update the listeners. Please. On masking. Okay, so the last time we talked, you had just talked to Dr. Osterholm, and Dr. Osterholm in those days was still very, very, very pro KN95, N95 masks or what have you. And then we were still dealing with Delta, and I had made the point that just people masking enough is enough. Like, you made the analogy of using like a seatbelt, the one that hooks up in your hip. At least it's not the ideal one that crosses, but at least it's a seatbelt and it works. And I thought that was a fair analogy. So with Omicron, there's no question now that KN95s and N95s are ideal. So if you are going out and about, so for me personally, here at the Daria Elliott household, we wear a KN95 and then we wear a cloth mask or a surgical mask over it so as to not, supposed to save the integrity of the KN95. It'll last a little bit longer. It won't soil as quickly, that sort of stuff. But it is important. I did want to kind of set the record straight from my previous statement, which was more geared toward Delta, Alpha, Wuhan, wild type. Now with Omicron and probably new variants, I think that the integrity of the masks need to be better.
And we should say that apparently Bernie just introduced a bill with 50 co-sponsors to deliver everybody N95 masks.
Nice. That's great.
So, I can't think of anything else at the moment, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on and answering these questions for us. I know that our audience really appreciates it as well.
Maybe I could just ask if you could clarify one thing, and I almost hesitate to ask because it might sound stupid, and Sam touched on it earlier, but does the this, and it is an addendum, so I apologize, but does the viral load that you receive directly connect with the viral load in numbers that you are putting out? Like, if you have a milder case, is there evidence to suggest?
100%.
Okay.
100%. All right. So it's all about viral load. So the higher the viral load in HIV, Ebola, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, influenza, in this case, COVID-19. The higher the viral load, the more likely to have a more severe expression of the disease, and the more the higher the ability to transmit to other people. So there is a one-to-one correlation on that.
Okay, just clarifying. Thank you.
And let me ask you about KF94s. Do you know anything about that, or is that
first? I'm hearing KF94. I think that they are made. I'm going to put it out there. I think they're made in Taiwan. I think that they're not unlike KN95s. I think. I read about something last week that was something about the mask, but I'm not 100% sure. But and if somebody was just asking about it, just to that listener, you want something that's going to fit tight across the face, ear loops that are tight, and that just has a fairly tight seal around it like that. And that's essentially what you want. So if it's a KN95, an N95, a KF94, which I think are made in another, I think it was Taiwan, but I may be wrong on that, that as long as it's tight fitting around the face, that's what you want. The N95s were meant to be like I use N95s when I go and I evaluate somebody in the hospital and they've got TB or they've got measles, right? or something. And those N95s are tight and they're only meant to be worn for short periods of time. Now, when I go to the hospital, I wear an N95 and I wear a surgical mask over it and I'm wearing it for 12 to like 14 hours a day, however long I'm in the hospital. And I've just kind of gotten used to breathing that way. But when I'm out and about, I don't use an N95. I just use a KN95 and those are equally as well. Again, they weren't meant to be used for long periods of time. So we're stretching the limit on those masks.
Mark Allen Derry, folks can check out the Noise Filter podcast, which is incredibly helpful. I really appreciate you coming on. We will talk
Thank
soon.
You.
In the meantime, get some rest. Well deserved to the extent that you can. And I hope, stay safe.
Thank you, Sam. And thank you, Emma.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. Someone's saying that the KF95s are Korean. I'm not 100% sure, but, look, if you're going on a plane, let's say, or you're going into a close quarters that you cannot avoid and you're indoors, N95. If you're out and about, you're going into a store, let's say for 10 minutes, KN95, KF94 is probably okay as well. That's basically, what the what your best practices are in that instance. But the bottom line is like there is no, there is no sort of threshold where it's like you're totally safe or you're totally unsafe. The more you do, you put your seatbelt on. A lap belt is better than no belt. A shoulder strap is better than just a lap belt. Having a airbag better than not having an airbag. Driving, the speed limit, not driving on ice.
But you got to drive.
Not driving on ice. If you could help. All of these things, we understand it in other contexts. It's the same in this context. It's just, what we don't fully understand is, and we really, do you really understand the risk of getting into a car accident? Like in terms of like what the odds are every time you get in the car, what they are to get into a car accident? No, but we just sort of like, we know that it's livable. The problem with, or the difficulty with COVID is that from day to day, we just don't know what the likelihood is that we're going to meet somebody who's infected, that we could get infected. As the variants change, the infectiousness of it changes. These are all unknowns. And anybody who is, whose job is to sit in front of a microphone and talk and tells you that they know, or that, someone's being too cautious, is an idiot. And they don't have your best interest in mind.
I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but I have this COVID-induced fantasy that when I'm in like a grocery store or something, that's I would like you know how the sim you guys know how the Sims would have like a something that would float above their head telling them their mood, like it'd be red if they were needing food or needing to go to the bathroom. I have that fantasy of like this person's COVID positive, stay away from them.
I mean,
I wish if that was my superpower.
Oh, that would be that would be awesome if you could see it actually.
Yeah,
but I mean, broadly speaking, I just try and limit the amount of time I'm in any one place. to the extent that I can. If I'm going into a store, I don't like linger around the produce.
Right.
As it were.
In and out.
We will clip that interview. Yes, we always do. We will clip that as soon as possible. We'll put that out quickly. Dorsey will get the message. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, but you also get the fun half as well, which will be a little truncated today. But,
We needed that.
We needed that. That guy, unbelievable the amount of that he works. I mean, just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And... I can't even imagine. But thank goodness for him. Really appreciate him coming on and check out the Noise Filter. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Letkin media universe?
Tonight Daniel Bessner will be joining Left Reckoning to talk about his piece on the end of politics, and Gene Bajelan, so two DBs, Gene Bajelan will be joining us to talk about Erdogan, Gulen, and to set the context for Enes Kanter and his sort of politics. We're going to take another pass at that, because Kanter is a Gulenist, and we're going to figure out what that means. And if we should be a little bit more, and I feel a little bit bad at how hard I went at Kanter for his political statements, even though they were dumb, and like the saying shut up and dribble to like LeBron and stuff was dumb. But he's like a 30-year-old kid that's been playing basketball and has had like issue, like run-ins with like Erdogan. So I want to get the full context. That's tonight. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get the postgame.
He doesn't seem like the brightest bulb.
I mean, I wouldn't be either if I was a professional basketball player, and like I'd spend a lot less time following politics, frankly.
Yes. Oh, come on, Matt. If you were a professional basketball player, you'd just be much better at basketball. That's all.
You'd be careening it, Matt.
I'd still be listening to like audiobooks, and I think I'd be slowing down a little bit on the news intake, though.
But at least he's no a-hole like Djokovic.
And I mean,
right?
Yes, but
I just wanted to be able to say Djokovic, right?
Well, you got it right.
Thank you.
Before the show, Sam's like, Jokic, you know? Jokic?
Yeah.
There's an extra.
He's the center for the Nuggets.
Yeah, right.
Folks, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.